Good evening. WBAI News presents Indie Radio News for Monday, November 12th, 2018. We are your hosts, Elia Grand and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip killed three Palestinians today. This came after a deadly Israeli special forces operation on Sunday. The renewed violence threatens to derail efforts to end months of unrest in the Middle East. UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, Nikolai Mladenov, tweeted that the UN is working closely with Egypt and all concerned to ensure that Gaza steps back from the brink. He says the escalation in the past 24 hours is extremely dangerous and reckless. Rockets must stop, restraint must be shown by all. And he adds no effort must be spared to reverse the spiral of violence. Turning now to the California wildfires. The death toll has risen to 29, matching the mark for the deadliest single blaze in the state's history. Nearly 230 people are still unaccounted for as rescue crews continue searching for bodies. Including two victims from a fire in Southern California, 31 people have died in total. California is requesting emergency aid from the Trump administration, but Donald Trump blames what he called poor forest management for the fires. On Saturday, he tweeted, "There is no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California except that forest management is so poor." He said billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of forests. Remedy now or no more Fed payments. California Governor Jerry Brown responded in a statement at a press conference Sunday that managing all the forests everywhere we can does not stop climate change, and those that deny that are definitely contributing to the tragedy. He adds things like this will be part of our future, things like this and worse. Scientists say hotter and drier conditions caused by climate change are leading to more intense and longer burning wildfires in the western United States. And in Florida, the election recount continues amid tensions in the pivotal gubernatorial and Senate races. Much of the controversy over the recount on Sunday centered on Broward and Palm Beach counties, home to large concentrations of Democratic voters. In Broward County, the recount was delayed for several hours Sunday morning because of a problem with one of the tabulation machines. And in Palm Beach County, the supervisor of elections said she doesn't believe her department will be able to meet the Thursday deadline to complete the recount. Governor Rick Scott, the Republican candidate for Senate, filed a lawsuit to impound and secure all voting machines, tallying devices, and ballots. Juan Penalosa, the executive director of the Florida Democratic Party, accused Scott of using his position to consolidate power by cutting at the very core of our democracy. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum said Trump and Scott are fighting like you know what to stop the vote count. That ought to tell you something.
Nearly 70 world leaders traveled to Paris to mark 100 years since the end of the First World War. French President Emmanuel Macron used the occasion on Sunday to sound a powerful and sobering warning about the fragility of peace and the dangers of nationalism and of nations putting themselves first above the collective good.
Car le patriotisme est l'exact contraire du nationalisme. Le nationalisme en est la trahison. En disant « nos intérêts d'abord et qu'importent les autres », on gomme ce qu'une nation a de plus précieux, ce qui la fait vivre, ce qui la porte à être grande, ce qui est le plus important, ses valeurs morales.
Macron says patriotism is the exact opposite of nationalism. By putting our own interests first, he says, with no regard for others, we erase the very thing that a nation holds dearest and the thing that keeps it alive, its moral values. In contrast to Donald Trump, who says he's a nationalist, Macron says nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism. In Paris, Macron has initiated 3 days of talks through Tuesday. It's called the Paris Peace Forum, an occasion for heads of states to come up with concrete initiatives for continued peace. Donald Trump didn't stay in Paris for the forum. His America First doctrine is in direct opposition to Macron's defense of multinationalism, which has been taking center stage.
In other news, Long Island City in Queens and Crystal City in Northern Virginia are being considered for a pair of big new East Coast bases for Amazon. But some New Yorkers don't think bringing Amazon to Queens is a good idea because it would create an undue burden on community members and on public transportation. New York State Senator Michael Giannaris and New York City Councilmember Jimmy Van Bramer say the burden should not be on the 99% to prove we are worthy of the 1%'s presence in our communities, but rather on Amazon to prove it would be a responsible corporate neighbor. Stan Lee, the creator of Spider-Man, the Fantastic Four, and the Incredible Hulk, died today in Los Angeles. He was 95 years old. Lee was considered the architect of the contemporary comic book. He revived the industry in the 60s by offering the costumes and action craved by younger readers while insisting on sophisticated plots, college-level dialogue, satire, science fiction, and even philosophy.
Thousands of Central American refugees are making their way across Mexico towards the southern U.S. border. The caravan, which is now in the thousands, started in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, with only about 160 people. After months of travel, the caravan has arrived in Mexico, but is still thousands of miles away from the U.S. border. Donald Trump, who classified the recent midterm elections as the election of the caravan, said there are Middle Easterners and criminals among the refugees and has recently stated that they carry multiple diseases. Trump has also threatened to deny access to anyone from the caravan seeking to enter the United States, including asylum seekers. Our guest today is journalist and filmmaker James Frederick, who has been traveling with the caravan in Guatemala and southern Mexico. James, this is not the first caravan to make its way up to the U.S. border with Mexico. In Honduras, for example, there have been caravans for decades. Can you talk a little bit about why people are fleeing?
Yeah, the main thing to understand about the caravan is it might look different from the rest of migration we see. It might be a disruption of how people are leaving, but it doesn't seem to be any significant change in what the push and pull factors of migration are. So, you know, when we talk about push factors, what makes somebody leave their country and what's making most of these people leave Honduras, which is the largest representation of people in the caravan, is just uncontrollable crime and violence. So that comes from multiple sources. You know, what you hear most often is people talking about gang violence. And, you know, from the time that I've spent in Honduras and then also just hearing people's stories, it just things become unlivable for people, whether they're being extorted, whether there has just been a threat against their life. You know, it takes very little to get on the wrong side of a gang. And once you're on the wrong side of a gang, you just can't live there. So I hear stories of people who have moved around Honduras and then, you know, they weren't safe even moving somewhere else in the country. So they had no choice to flee. But it's not just gang violence. There is state-level violence. I've talked to people who said they were threatened by police, and that's the reason they left. But it's also not just violence. There's lots of farmers that you meet in the caravan, and they cite droughts, and they, you know, cite growing cycles just going completely out of whack. And so a lot of people are saying that is climate change that is making being a farmer much and much harder. And so people are leaving because they don't have a way to make money. It's a combination of factors, but we're mostly talking about violence, not being safe in Honduras, and economic factors. They cannot make enough money to live in Honduras.
So you have been traveling with the caravan. Can you explain the danger of the actual route of the caravan and the importance of traveling in a large group? In other words, what's the purpose of having a caravan in the first place?
Well, first of all, to put it into context, I actually saw a new stat this morning from Customs and Border Patrol's latest numbers of how many people they've arrested trying to cross the border. And the daily average of people crossing the border undocumented into the United States is about 2,000 per day. So the idea that we're freaking out over somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 people in this first caravan is, first of all, just crazy. It's not an unprecedented number at all. But as far as the idea that these people might be a threat to the country, first of all, from the people that I've spoken to and the word from the caravan in general is that they don't plan to jump across the border. They don't plan to cross the river into the United States. They plan to hand themselves in at a port of entry and request asylum. So the idea that those people are a threat, people that are showing up to the United States specifically to ask for protection, to ask for asylum in the United States, is completely contradictory to the idea of what asylum is for. It's there to protect people, and they need protection, and they say they want that. And so the idea that this is, one, an unprecedented number of people is just not the case. But the reason they're in a caravan and the reason it looks different right now is that Mexico is so dangerous and so difficult to get across. There are tens of thousands of migrants that have gone missing in the last several years as they crossed Mexico. Many migrants are killed. It's almost impossible to find someone who has migrated, you know, not in a large group, but just migrated on their own across Mexico and wasn't the victim of a crime, whether that's, you know, organized crime, robbing or kidnapping them. They're very often extorted by Mexican police. So the reason people are in a caravan is because it is the safest way to get across Mexico. Because if you go with a smuggler, you put yourself in the hands of organized crime. If you try to not go with a smuggler and stay away from organized crime, you will be hunted by either Mexican police, Mexican migration, organized crime. There are just so many risks. And so what these people in the caravan are saying is that I need to leave my country. I want to get to the United States, but it is not safe the way that most people currently do it. So we're going to band together and we're going to find safety and strength in numbers.
I want to shift for a second to Mexico's migration policies. We don't talk about that very much in comparison to how much we talk about U.S. policies. Can you tell us about the challenges people are facing in Mexico when they arrive there with the caravan?
Yeah, you don't hear very much about what Mexico's stance on migration is. But to give you an idea, last year in 2017, Mexico deported 78,000 Central Americans that it had arrested undocumented in Mexico. In 2017, ICE deported 74,000 Central Americans from the U.S. So last year, Mexican migration authorities deported more Central Americans than ICE did. So in terms of raw numbers, Mexico is often deporting more people from Central America than the United States is. And so that gives you an idea of what Mexico's role in this is. It's interesting, though, because the way Mexico does it looks very different from the way the U.S. does it. So Mexico's southern border with Guatemala is not guarded in the same way. So these caravans have all gotten into Mexico by crossing the river, most of them on little rafts going across the Suchiate River. And Mexican authorities watch that happen. They really don't stop people crossing the river. There's a pretty vibrant black market trade of goods across that river, and they don't stop it at all. So people can get into Mexico quite easily, but that is when things really become difficult for migrants. They are, they're hunted either by organized crime, which very often extorts, kidnaps, blackmails migrants. And then Mexican migration authorities have basically set up a system, and they did this in conjunction with the Mexican military, of a containment zone in southern Mexico where they basically create layers of checkpoints and sweeps and patrols to find and detain migrants that are in Mexico in the southern part of the country. They want to get them there and then deport them very quickly. And as the numbers show, with Mexico often deporting more people to Central America than the U.S. does, Mexico does a very good job about it. The other thing that's odd in Mexico, though, is it's not a big hot political issue here like it is in the United States. But seeing how significant of a role Mexico is playing in migration, in detaining and deporting people who are often fleeing violence. It really should be. Mexico's role in this should be understood, and it should be debated more than it is.
So looking forward to what's going to happen, you know, in the next little while, what do you foresee happening when this caravan arrives at the U.S.-Mexico border?
Well, I doubt... I also hope that nothing happens involving the military on the U.S. side. It just doesn't seem like there's anything for them to do. The caravan is certainly not going to try to storm across the U.S. border. I think more what we're going to have is we're going to have a slow burn crisis on the Mexican side. So what we've seen happening recently is that with so many people showing up at the U.S. border to request asylum, many people now just camp on the bridges into the U.S. because they're waiting to get an appointment with an asylum official in the U.S. so they can say they want to request asylum. But people are camping there for weeks or even months. And then on top of that, we're going to have thousands more from these caravans that are coming through Mexico, joining this long line of people who are trying to request asylum in the U.S. It really feels right now like U.S. authorities are trying to make this as slow and difficult as possible to try to turn people away, to try to convince people that they shouldn't come to the U.S. border to request asylum. So I think instead of anything immediate and dramatic happening, we're going to see thousands of people camped out mostly in Tijuana on the U.S.-Mexico border. And, you know, these people have nothing. They have nowhere to go. There really isn't the humanitarian capacity right now in Tijuana to take care of these people. But they're going to be camped out there trying to get asylum. And so I think instead of anything immediate and dramatic happening, we're going to have really desperate people who are kind of being put through attrition by the U.S. government to try to convince them to not request asylum. And we need to see what response Mexico does to that. On December 1st, the new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, takes power in Mexico. And that will be one of the first things he has to try to deal with, is what to do with all of these people camped on Mexico's northern border trying to get into the U.S. And there's going to need to be a humanitarian response to them.
Thank you so much for joining us, James. Stay tuned for part two of Indie Radio News here on WBAI, where we'll continue to talk about the caravan with journalist Maya Aberbuch, who has been traveling with the caravan for the past 3 weeks.
Now we go live to Mexico and speak with Maya Aberbuch, who is with the Central American Caravan. She has been traveling with the caravan as a freelance journalist for the last 3 weeks.
So right now the caravan has just arrived to Guadalajara, a city in the state of Jalisco. It left Mexico City a few days ago, which is the point at which it had stopped for the longest time, and started making its way further north, opting to go along the western coast of Mexico because it's safer, and they have the destination of Tijuana, which is one of the longest routes to get to the border, but definitely one of the safest ones. And so right now people have been traveling large distances every day, primarily by lining up on the highway and the help of Mexican authorities, boarding the backs of trailers and at times into local bus companies in order to spread across these distances and then reunite in the afternoon and evening every day at some outdoor space, be it a government center, be it an auditorium, be it a sports center where they can sleep for the night.
Aberbuch says transportation for the caravan is loosely organized. Truckers often pick up migrants.
But we've seen truckers who are transporting steel who allowed the migrants to climb on top. We saw one truck that usually is used to transport livestock that the migrants had climbed into. There's these large multi-wheelers that have big spaces in the back where migrants at times do ride in general in the year, but very illegally. Whereas here, because the group is so large, we've seen in each city, local authorities, which means police as well as civil protection services, and different church groups or nonprofits aid the migrants in boarding these different forms of informal transport. So there's no transport that is being directly provided by the government to get everyone to the next point, but there is a sense that the government is not able to stop the movement, so that the best it can do is assist people so that there isn't a crisis of sorts in which people board a trailer that is then unsafe, or where the number of the truck is unknown such that that vehicle then sometimes disappears. And so there are basic security measures that are put in place. And the local governments in each city have made themselves responsible for determining where they can accommodate these 5,000 people. And so often those are sports centers. Sometimes it's a government shelter. Yesterday it was a government shelter that's usually used for orphans or for families. And so whatever space that can really hold this community of people.
Most of the caravan is exhausted, but Aberbrag says once it left Mexico City, there was a renewed sense of resolve.
A lot of issues arose at different points of the caravan because there was a promise that people would be given official government buses, and there was this idea that maybe they could all board buses and get to the border in a matter of 2 days. And first, that offer was given to them when they were in the south, in the state of Veracruz. When they were in Mexico City, they went to the United Nations offices and tried to ask for this again and were turned down. And so I think that people now become impatient and realize that they're not going to get that sort of help, and so they could do the best with what they are getting, and are going to great lengths in order to do that, which means getting up at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. every day in order to go and wait on the highways, often in very high heat. I talked to a migrant this morning whose wife had ended up in the hospital, who'd ended up there with their 9-month-old kid because she fainted. And there are a lot of people who are still sick and who are being attended by local public health officials or by the Red Cross, but they sort of have to continue marching on and often pick staying with the group and the security of that over staying to rest in some place, even if their feet are blistered or they're sick or they've become exhausted.
Donald Trump issued a proclamation to deny asylum to migrants who enter the country illegally. This goes against laws that state that anyone can request asylum no matter how he or she enters the country. The plan is immediately being challenged in court. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and other legal groups sued in federal court in Northern California on Friday to block the regulations. They argue that Trump's proclamation is illegal. Aberbuck says caravan members asked her about this.
Some people have heard elements of it. So I think in general, people have passed around the news that the border has become militarized. A couple people asked me if it was true that Trump had closed down asylum, which is not exactly right. Right? Trump has temporarily banned asylum if people are crossing between ports of entry, but you know, rumors don't necessarily include all of that information. And so snippets of American news get to people, and I think they understand generally that it will be very hard because the president is opposed to them. But a lot of people have a lot of faith, and I think also have relatives who have previously crossed into the U.S. and so think that their only chance of getting to the U.S. is trying to go in this large group, and that maybe somehow that the president will let them through, or that the president will issue some of them work permits or give some portion of them asylum. But that is really a problem that they're going to deal with once they are geographically on the border, as opposed to trying to decide now.
The caravan, which started with people walking, has transformed into people seeking alternate means of transportation. But the caravan is still hundreds of miles from the U.S. southern border. Welcome back to Indie Radio News on WEI 99.5. Next on our special show on Migrant Caravan, we're going to talk to Tristan Call. He is currently with the caravan as a volunteer for the organization Pueblo Sin Fronteras, an NGO that accompanies migrants and refugees.
I think it's extraordinary that with all of the pressure that the United States is putting on Mexico to basically, I mean, the way in Mexico people talk about it is to do the dirty work of the U.S., that the U.S. Has been embarrassed for so long to do directly to people. So they fund, you know, Mexican police to extend that, you know, that terrorism against migrants down to the within Mexico. I think that seeing the president of Mexico go on national TV and say people will not enter this country, they will not be allowed into Mexico, they will not be taken care of, they're criminals, and so on. And to see hundreds of thousands of Mexicans, especially in the south, and we'll see in the remaining parts of the journey, hundreds of thousands of Mexicans simultaneously defying entirely their president and their government in one of the biggest acts of civil disobedience that I've ever seen. It's pretty extraordinary. And I think it, you know, has a lot to do with the fact that they have the shared experience of having been treated badly by the United States, their own families as migrants in the U.S. I think it also has to do with the lack of trust that Mexicans have in their own government, and seeing it as, you know, essentially the U.S. pulling the strings behind the scenes in a way that doesn't reflect the actual interests of poor Mexican people, at least. So that's been pretty extraordinary, just to see people casually and in enormous numbers defying their own government, right, to choose sides and on the side of the Central Americans.
I hear in the back, Tristan, there's noise. Have you guys advanced at all? Has there been any now? Because now you're hitchhiking. I take it people are trying to find their
exactly.
way.
Yeah, exactly. There's actually, I wish I knew exactly what these buses are. Company buses pulling up and police and other volunteers, like, helping talk to the drivers about the route, helping lift strollers on, helping get the kids on, in a few cases helping get, you know, this is like a guy with a chihuahua, a guy with a pit bull, you know, people that getting their pets on, and moving up the periférico to get to the northern edge of the city. It's just something we've seen all along the way, is coordination between, you know, people who are willing to lose some money for a few hours to just extend a hand. We've all got the same cold, basically. But of course, like, other people have needs. There's pregnant women. There's people with, you know, other kinds of, like, medical needs. The Mexico City government deployed, I think, 47, like, vans, basically, like mobile medical vans, which have been a huge help. Mostly it's been Mexican state and city governments that have helped the most with the medical support. But there's also been some nonprofit organizations that have supported as well. The Red Cross comes along with us on the route to help out with emergency assistance, and that's been really useful as well.
How many days are you, when do you expect to get to the U.S. border, more or less?
It's a great question that I'd be making up an answer if I said.
Okay.
But, you know, I would. It won't be tomorrow, but hopefully we'll get there before you know, a month has passed.
Thank you for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from Indie Radio News. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. Follow all our latest coverage online at independent.org, that's indie with a Y, and via social media. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or find out how to subscribe to The Independent's print edition, we can be reached at 212-904-1282 or contact at independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and see you next week.